tonight we're going to have a forum on the topic of redesigning people. Should we? To help us start off our conversation tonight, and I would assume there would be some lively opinions on this topic, we have David Legree, who is on our teaching staff at this point. He teaches biochemistry at Washington Central?
Central Washington University
in Ellensburg. And he's going to give us some definitions and a little study to start from.
Okay, what I thought I'd do is give a little background for about 10 or 15 minutes and then present you with the situation, and you can function as a review board for a proposed experiment involving human beings, and I'd be interested in your reaction, questions in terms of details and so on, but you'll function as a review board. But I'd like to set a little bit of background information. The dawn of genetic engineering in some ways started with the discovery of the structure of DNA, which is the hereditary material that carries our genetic characteristics. One of the people who won a Nobel Prize for that work, his name is James Watson, and he wrote a book a number of years ago, and there's a passage in there that is rather striking. He was talking about shortly after when he and a co-worker, Francis Crick, realized what the structure of DNA was. And it turns out that by knowing the structure, they also knew a lot about how it works. And the passage is, "I felt slightly queasy when at lunch Francis, his cohort, winged in to tell everyone within hearing distance that we had found the secret of life, the structure of DNA. DNA is essentially a blueprint. It carries the instructions for the genetic characteristics that a cell will have. And when we talk about redesigning people, I'm not talking about selective breeding, variation in our reproductive techniques. I'm talking about starting with an existing organism and providing new, different genetic information that will provide them with genetic capabilities they didn't have before. And that's what we're dealing with. One of the main techniques for doing this was discovered, as many scientific ideas develop, at a delicatessen in Waikiki. Before some scientific meetings, there were two groups of scientists who just were good friends and happened to be discussing their work. One group had discovered a way to take out of bacteria little ringlets of DNA. It's very easy to isolate them from bacteria and to put them back into bacteria. The other group had discovered something that's in essence a scalpel of DNA. It's called an enzyme, but it's something that cuts DNA, and it cuts it in such a way that it leaves edges that have certain chemical signals. So if you put another piece of DNA with the same kind of edges or ends, they'll stick together. And if we put together these two ideas, one of the main strategies now is to take out of bacteria this little ringlet of DNA, open it with this scalpel, get our other DNA that we're going to end up providing to the bacteria, and treat it so it has this, these ends, put it together with our other ringlet, and the ringlet will seal back into a ringlet, but now it's got the new piece, a hybrid piece that's now added in there, and then we feed the ringlet back in. So now it's carrying back into the bacteria a piece of DNA that wasn't previously in the bacteria. And that DNA now carries genetic information. That's not the only way of providing new DNA back into cells, but it's one of the methods that's most widely used now. It turns out, and this happened just in about 1973, so we're talking about a capability that has developed very recently. It turns out that you can put back into bacteria DNA from all kinds of organisms. Yes, you can put bacterial DNA, new bacterial DNA in. You can put plant DNA. You can put human DNA. You can take DNA, a chunk of DNA that you chemically make in the laboratory, splice that in and feed it back into bacteria. And if you do it right, the new DNA, whatever its source, works and functions in the bacteria, and the bacteria does new tricks that new piece of DNA tells it to do. Okay, so with that capability, what kind of uses are possible for it? One of the techniques, or one of the uses that is really causing an explosion right now among pharmaceutical companies and in other areas, is to basically program bacteria, make them into little miniature factories for some product, give them the DNA to make some product that you need, and make those bacteria into little miniature factories making insulin, growth hormone, things that can work as vaccines, products of this type. And the interesting thing about it, since you can put any kind of DNA in the bacteria, you can get them to make the human version of insulin or of growth hormone. As a result of this, there are microbes produced that have genetic capabilities that, at least as far as we know, have never existed before. There's obviously a big market for some of these, and I'm sure a number of you are aware that a few years ago, General Electric petitioned the Supreme Court to get a patent on a microbe that they had produced, actually a little bit differently than the way I've described. But they produced, in essence, a new microbe and said, we would like to use this as our product. It was a microbe that potentially could eat up materials in oil, use it on cleaning up oil spills. Supreme Court said that the patent law as written did not exclude forms of life, and so now, at least in this case, forms of life are patentable as products that are produced by the manufacturer for a particular purpose. Okay, a lot of the work right now is being done with bacteria, tailoring them for particular purposes. There is also interest in tailoring other forms of life. Plants, there are a number of ideas floating around. One of the ideas that hasn't been done that is fondly pursued is to teach plants to be able to fix nitrogen. Instead of using fertilizers, nitrogen fertilizers, enable the plants, give them the genetic ability to do this themselves. It would save a lot of energy and have other advantages. What I'd like to do, though, is go beyond these particular forms of life and talk about using techniques of this type on human beings. What kind of situations? I've talked rather glibly about the technology, and let me say it's not nearly as easy, and you can't get things tailored exactly the way you want nearly as easily as I've described. Nevertheless, as this capability is improved, how would we use it with humans? What I'd like to present to you is an actual situation that arose about a little over a year ago now. I'll tell you how it came out after you decide how it should come out. One of the first uses of genetic modification in humans would be to deal with genetic disorders. If people lack a particular genetic capability, particularly if this is manifest in one particular organ, if every cell in the body will lack that genetic capability, but maybe only a certain organ needs that capability, and so there would be a handy target to focus the efforts in on. The situation is some people who have a disease, it's a certain form of something called thalassemia. This is a disorder where the bone marrow genetically is not able to make the hemoglobin that carries the oxygen around, or at least it doesn't make it in the normal form. Okay, so people who have this disorder, it's a genetic disorder, fairly common, particularly in people with Mediterranean descent. It isn't as common here as it is in certain other parts, particularly of Europe. People who have this problem get continuous transfusions to provide them with this. But as a result of continuing to do these transfusions over a period of time, they keep getting more and more iron. And the iron accumulates in their tissues, causes damage, and they have a very shortened life expectancy with this method of treatment. Okay, the situation is that a scientist at UCLA had done some experiments with bone marrow cells in mice. He had taken some cells out from the mice and had provided them with three new genes, including this gene that is needed for the people who have this blood disorder. It was put back into, these cells were then put back into the bone marrow, and it turns out that two of the three genes in those cells that were returned started to function. The gene that didn't function was the one that was needed, okay, the hemoglobin one. But perhaps the scientists rationalized this was a human gene. The other two genes that were put into these mouse cells were mouse genes, and maybe there was some kind of a language problem. Okay, well, this is basically all the background experimental work that had been done. There were some people who requested of this scientist permission to try a similar type of experiment. They were people who had about 1 year life expectancy based on the conventional treatment of transfusions. They asked this person to try this experiment with them, remove bone marrow cells, try to insert the needed gene, grow up a bunch of those cells, insert it back in the bone marrow, use a little radiation to knock out some of the regular bone marrow population, so they might have enough bone marrow cells producing the needed hemoglobin so that they could function normally. Is that too complicated? Okay.
And they were from the Mediterranean area.
Yeah, the two cases.
They were not United States citizens.
Yeah, one girl was from Israel and one was from Italy, yeah, in this case. And
the Klein case.
That's right. And permission was asked. There was a review board at UCLA. Would you give these people permission? Would you give the scientists permission to carry out this experiment under the described conditions? Now, there may be additional information you feel you need before rendering a verdict, and if you want to ask questions, I'd supply what I can on that. So how would you proceed with this request now?
Are there dangers involved?
To the girls, they would undergo some mild radiation treatment. That's about the extent of it. There is a danger of the unknown. If the genes are put into them, how well they would function, if they would function under control, is a totally unknown factor.
What were the rules? You might explain what the rules were he was operating under his... He was operating really under an NIH grant, wasn't it? Some of this was.
Under what?
Under an NIH grant.
Yeah.
And there are certain rules that apply here, right?
Well, there's an elaborate protocol,
yeah,
that you have to, in terms of safety, anytime you do experiments with gene splicing, there's always concern about creating some kind of hazardous combination that could be dangerous. And there are elaborate safety precautions in place, and he would have to proceed in line with these, so there wouldn't be that danger, or at least he would be proceeding as safely as anyone else with work.
Dave, did the girls initiate the request?
It's my understanding that they did. However, the scientist was very receptive and had speculated that as a result of the kind of work that he had done, that there might someday be possible application. So in a sense, a seed had been planted as well.
What was the diagnosis if nothing was done?
The girls had a year to live.
Okay, this is what I thought.
How old were the girls?
One was 16, one was 21. The Israeli girl was 16, and as I understand it, someone of that age in Israel is more considered an adult than would be the case here.
How about opportunity to understand? Explanation possible? Girls bright enough?
Informed consent is always an ideal, never perfectly realized. The girls were given the full information, the experimental work had been done. They were told that the likelihood of success was exceedingly low, they were told what the inconvenience they would undergo was. The scientist was satisfied that there was a reasonable degree of understanding given the age and maturity of the girls. There's always a compromising factor that they are, perhaps there's a sense of desperation from their point of view given their physical condition.
And we are a review board of the university.
Yeah.
And we're worried about the responsibility of the university and its possible legal obligations if something goes wrong.
Well, you have to decide if, well, if informed consent was, you have to decide if there was a reasonable informed consent. I really can't give you much more details than I have on that point here. You also have to decide whether it's reasonable at this point for the experiment to go on, whether there was sufficient expectation.
But the bottom line is, if something should go wrong, will the university, which has asked me to screen this thing, be held liable?
Yeah, I
don't wonder where I'm coming from, you know. Am I thinking about the welfare of the girl, or am I thinking about the welfare of the university? And I guess the girls didn't appoint me.
But the other thing you have to worry about is that you have a big grant from NIH. And if you don't live by their rules, if you break their rules, you're going to get wiped out.
Yeah.
The protocol. Yes, that's true. But the protocol for the experiment was in full conformance with the
with their
rules that they have to follow. Yeah.
But do the stipulations allow experimentation on human beings in this protocol?
Yeah. Well, they're just doing experiments with cells in the protocol, and then there is a value judgment of whether it's reasonable, whether we're at the therapeutic stage now. But they aren't violating any rules. There's a value judgment now whether we're at a stage where it's reasonable to apply it to humans.
Can the girls sign something which would put the university off the hook?
I don't know if that would be legal.
Particular suit.
Got a couple minors, or at least one.
And that means that they can't be arranged, parents or guardians. It could be arranged so that the university would be off the hook, right?
Well, maybe Dave's going to tell us about whether there were parents or guardians or whether somebody was appointed for that function.
The minors, it turns out, the reason I can't give you that information, I don't want to give away the what happened for those of you who don't know. It turns out that the work didn't end up being done in the United States, and both of these people were recognized as having the legal right to make that decision for themselves in the countries where the work ended up being done. So that didn't turn out to be an issue. Whether it would in the U.S., that I can't tell. Yeah.
What sort of previous experience is there in introducing moderately engineered cells into different human structures?
Virtually zero. Okay. This is the first time. Yeah, there's no background of information against which to.
Except a failed experiment in mice.
Yeah.
Well, is this the issue then, that it would establish a precedent in genetic engineering, or is it just another case of whether, how far you can go with experimentation in human beings.
Well, I think we'll, what I'd like to focus on just for the moment is, would you grant the scientist permission to carry out the experiment under the protocol that he prescribed with the consent of the girls? And we'll certainly want to go on to drawing boundaries. You know, we're talking about correcting a genetic disorder at the moment. We'll certainly get into what constitutes a disorder. Is 5 feet tall a disorder? Is color blindness a disorder that we're going to intervene? But at the moment, can we justify proceeding with this experiment under the conditions?
Is there any particular reason why that one gene didn't take? Did they have any particular?
Well, it doesn't.
The one that was supposed to work, but didn't. That was the one.
In mice.
Yeah, in mice they don't know why yet.
Maybe we can go ahead and take a vote and work from there and see what.
Are you ready to vote?
Sure.
All right. How many of you would grant permission to proceed?
As usual, Vern and I differ.
How many of you would?
That's encouraging.
How many would deny permission?
The lawyer blood comes out here.
Well, permission turned out to be denied. However, the researcher kind of had, and one of the main reasons given was that there wasn't sufficient experimental work done with the animals to justify proceeding to this stage. That is, there wasn't a reasonable likelihood that it would do any good. And there was some inconvenience to the girls, yes.
Were there any similar disorders in animals that they tried that with? Not just the particular one they were looking for in humans when they did it on the mice, but were there like a similar disorder particular only to a certain species of animal that they tried it with?
Leo, you might have. Not that I know of. They certainly haven't.
But there's been a lot of work related to this. There are some things I know about this, but this is being taped, isn't it?
Yes.
I know of Klein's work for a long time. Before he was at NIH, before I went to UCLA, in the cancer field. But when you turn off the tape recorder.
Seems to me that the issue here is, when is it okay, not if what the scientific background is, but when is the time it's okay, or is it okay ever?
Yeah, I know. If they were successful with mice, would it be all right?
Yeah.
I think we can be fairly confident that the time will come where the capability, at least if there's a genetic disorder due to the lack of a single gene, I'm not talking about a condition such as Down syndrome, mongolism, where the genetic disorder is not one of a deficit. There's actually additional genetic material here, but where we have a deficit of a functional gene, those kinds of situations, including sickle cell anemia would be another one, Tay-Sachs disease, there are a lot of them. I think we can anticipate the capability will be there, and we will need to decide where to draw the line.
Yeah, I think nobody's really looking at it from the other side of these two girls that are going to die. And I think that, you know, they have certain rights too, and whether there's experimental background or not, mice aren't people. And even if you answer it in mice, it's still not going to answer it in people.
So are you just giving the go-ahead?
Or I sure would. You know, I would just put myself in their place, and if I knew I was going to die, I think I would be willing. I think the desperation factor is pretty important.
I think when you're, in my judgment on this, I'll give you some reservations later, but advances in medicine have been made by taking risks. And I place myself in as you do, in their position. And at their age, they ought to be able to make some judgment. Now, you have to make some the judgment with some knowledge of capabilities and possibilities. Maybe if there's something in the offing and it's hard to predict a breakthrough, what if there were a great breakthrough 6 months from now and this didn't work, you know, that'll goof it up. You have to weigh that. But placing myself in them, and much of our advances have been made by taking risks, by sacrifice in a way, both in the animals and the people. Some of us have volunteered for missions in which it was the potential was great for sacrifice. That your life was gonna, if it was lost, it would save a lot more. And here there, my judgment is based on that they got a chance that may win. And if not win, at least some, they'll get some new knowledge. And that's the basis for my judgment.
Let me just briefly comment. It turns out they weren't granted permission. He applied to Israel and to Italy for permission to do the experiments there. He got permission to do the experiments there before he heard word from UCLA, went over there, did the work, came home, got turned down by UCLA, which was a bit after the fact. It turns out that the experiment didn't appear to make any difference. It didn't work. It didn't make any difference. The girls didn't suffer any particular discomfort. However, because he was turned down and did the experiments in his local, or did it elsewhere, he's in hot trouble and has resigned at least his administrative post where he's located, and that thing is still pending, and his brand is in trouble. But let's suppose we have the capability to do this. Would you draw any boundaries? Is there anything that would be prohibited?
When you say we have the capabilities, you mean that it's now established that the process will work, or that we have permission to experiment with it?
That it will work.
That it will work.
Yeah. Would you, are there any inherent boundaries?
Well, I think there's a certain attitude of mind to be taken in consideration as to whether it's a life-saving procedure or whether it's just, you might say, a cosmetic procedure.
Would you tend to restrict it, do you think, to a life-saving procedure?
That would be my thought at the moment.
Would you restrict it to repairing a disorder? That is, you wouldn't use it to increase some type of capability that someone might consider desirable? I mean, can we distinguish between what is a disorder and what's a mild deficit? We have a whole range, a spectrum of genetic abilities and disabilities normally among us.
If there was an ability to increase the quality of life for somebody who really faced a pretty poor quality of life, I think that should be taken into serious consideration. I'm thinking of somebody, say, if there was an ability to change Down syndrome to make normal, or say a diabetic, or if there's some way to change that they became non-diabetic, that's certainly an increased quality of life.
But aren't there always going to be people that would consider things that we may not consider to increase their quality of life, if they were better looking or if they were taller? Or so how can, you know, that phrase to increase the quality of life?
They have to come from them. They think that they
need boundaries too.
Height is a life-threatening illness now.
What is it?
Height.
Oh. Well, I think you have to first define what is a life-saving procedure.
But what if aging is a genetically determined thing? You want to stop that? Not to grow old.
Well, that's questionable.
I'm not sure I'd always want to be young either.
Stop it originally.
Dave, you made a distinction between adding something to the structure and removing, as if in, there is a major difference there. Would you care to speak more to that?
Well, the technology right now is geared for ways to provide genetic information.
To add only.
Yeah. The prospects of subtracting aren't within current sight. Who knows what's around the corner, but that isn't in the cards as far as
you were not therefore making a judgment about it's all right to do one, or it might be all right to do one and not the other.
No, I'm saying the capability for the one type will come.
That's helpful.
I think we can be fairly confident about that. I don't think we can be about the other type.
Dave, is there anything different, basically, in genetic engineering that we've not already done? The first time that anybody gave somebody a rub down or a drink of hot water and thereby intervened in that person's odds of surviving or not surviving. Certainly medicine for years now has prevented deaths, I guess, at birth and in other ways that have changed the odds of the evolutionary process. This may be more rapid, it may be more dramatic, and that might be an awfully good reason for not doing it. I mean, one can make the same argument about the atomic bomb versus stabbing everybody with a bayonet, one at a time rather than by thousands and hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, I didn't know how much I dared mention evolution here. But there are those who say that this would be an opportunity for us to make changes in a very conscious and directed way rather than using the current mechanisms of natural selection, random mutations. We, in a sense, we have a tool whereby we can decide what qualities we want and go about pursuing that in a more direct way than leaving it to the throw of the dice with reproduction and the environment selecting out this and that. That, of course,
underneath my question really lies just exactly that fear. It's a relatively simple thing to intervene with a process. To my mind, it's a much more complex thing to decide why and where you want to go with it. Now, I'm afraid of our ability, I'm concerned about our ability to make any kinds of judgments about what the ideal human would be. And until I've got some handle on where I would want humanity to wind up, I'm not in a great big hurry to have anybody start pushing it to where they think it ought to be.
That still sort of assumes that we can establish some sort of genetic basis for some fairly large and extremely complex human structures. It's not like we can go and find a gene for the brain and remove it and put in one that makes it bigger or stronger on one side than the other. Or any of that engineering at this point is providing the skills for, or the material to create a particular protein or a particular combination of proteins, and not that you could make somebody grow 8 feet tall. At this point in time, it's not clear to me that how you define these sort of one particular gene for bone marrow, and then when you climb the ladder to some sort of eugenics program, that's a long way.
Yeah, we're making a massive jump in the assumptions in terms of technology. Many of the characteristics, for example, IQ, to the extent that there is a hereditary component, and that, of course, is hotly argued about, is at least a polygenic characteristic. That is, there are a lot of genes that would contribute to it, and this would be true of other characteristics. These are much more difficult characteristics to build in than correcting deficits.
Maybe you can get down to a couple of cases. You mentioned Tay-Sachs or diabetes. It would be interesting from this group, you know. Pick one of those, maybe, that they all, you know, where we are, maybe in doing something about Tay-Sachs or juvenile diabetes.
Okay, let me
run the scenario on it.
Okay, diabetes is kind of an interesting one because there's genetic engineering is it could be helpful in two different ways. One is it's a way to turn microbes into producers of human insulin. Now, that doesn't cure the disorder, but people who are diabetic get their insulin from, they don't get human insulin. They get beef or pork insulin. It's not the same chemically. Some people react. There's getting to be some problem of supply. So human insulin made by bacteria would be maybe cheaper, probably have less problem with side effects. That would be beneficial. But what about actually giving people the capability to produce their own insulin? One of the big problems in the genetic engineering is it's one thing just to get the gene into the cells. That's easy enough to do. But you have to get the gene to work, and not only to work for producing the product, but you have to be able to turn it on and off when you need it turned on and off. We produce insulin. The way we produce insulin is interrelated to our blood sugar levels. And as many of you know, if you have someone who's diabetic and they get too much insulin at one time, it lowers the blood sugar levels so low that they go into a coma, pass out. What if we supplied people with the gene for producing insulin and got it turned on, but it just kept producing huge amounts of insulin? People would die of insulin shock. So the technology itself is a major problem. There hasn't been any real work done on trying to get the insulin gene in. There are other things, transplanting in cells, the special cells of the pancreas that produce insulin. You can put them in little plastic coils and do other things to protect them from a rejection problem, transplant little bits of tissue. There's some artificial devices you can hook up to people to monitor blood sugar and then inject little bits of insulin depending on the sugar levels, those kinds of things.
But there, I'd like to stop you now and see what the audience feels. As you see, on the one hand, if we were successful in transplanting to a child, well, it's a longer onset, we're operative. You see, would you look at that differently than if you could put in the gene that would do it from there on? You see, that's...
You mean providing...
One is genetic engineering and one is not, and one isn't.
Yeah.
Would we look at it differently?
Works.
Pardon?
It's not a technology that presently works. If you can produce a bacterium that will produce human insulin in some sort of commercially useful quantities, and all that is required is to inject it, it's a different... is another alternative to, in some way, intervening in the human genetic structure.
Yeah, but if you've been a child and you have to be held down every day to get your insulin, you wish there was a better way.
Right.
So the question before the house then is, would the people look at it differently? If you could put in the gene and have it regulated so it functioned as well as a transplant of the islet lining ring, should the requirements be different?
We could look at a very analogous case would be these same two girls we talked about earlier. Suppose instead of taking out their cells, putting in the gene, we could give them bone marrow cells that had the capability, enough of them that would produce enough hemoglobin that they would be okay, and you could do it somehow without a rejection problem. Would that be a different, would your feelings about that be different than doing it with their own cells?
Do you think UCLA would have looked on it differently?
No.
I bet they might have.
Sure would have.
Yeah. That's a point I was getting.
Who wants to decide these things, though? Who wants to be the review board? Who's capable of being that?
Another thing, too, that we haven't addressed at all is once this technology becomes available, who's going to pay for it? Because it's going to be very expensive. Is the country as a whole going to accept this as a responsibility so that all can be served by the technology available? Certainly they're not all going to be able to afford it.
It costs us money in the long run, though. You'll have less people that are sick that you want me to take care of.
One of the long-term costs, on the other hand, is that you might repair their bone marrow cells, and so maybe they reach reproductive age, whereas they might not have before, unless you also change their egg or sperm cells. They're going to have offspring with a certain risk factor, and they might not have had offspring otherwise. Now you could impose restrictions on reproduction.
Had those kind of ideas too.
Well, and your point is a good one, and it applies in medicine today. I mean, can we afford heart transplants? And, you know, when you brought up the fact, well, you first say it's life-threatening, which is a pretty good, that's a pretty good criteria. Then we go to quality of life, and then we want to change height or appearance, then the expense does go up, and somebody has to make the judgment. It's like my 10th law, there's no complex problem, which if looked at in a proper way, doesn't become more complex.
Okay. Is color blindness life-threatening in any way?
If it's red and green,
could you fix some kinds of color blindness and not others? Well, you have a condition such as diabetes if you have, depending on the type of diabetes, but there is a certain length of life that is can reasonably be expected without genetic intervention. How big an increment, how big a quality difference do we need before we say it's fallen to intervene?
That was my second comment, was the definition of life threatening. And that's the joke in the back.
All the things that muscular dystrophy, say forward.
Every such case is in competition with 50 other lives. If you spend the money to do a transplant, you condemn 50 other people to death. I'm making up my numbers. Seattle has just decided to replace a Gross plan and its floating bridge. Predictable cost for every life that's been lost on that bridge because of the drawbridge. For years in Seattle, you've known how much money has been saved and what cost in human suffering. I decided to replace the draw span and save that number of lives. In a world of scarce economics, you're going to kill 50 people on the draw span by not having a straight road, or save one life by a genetic transplant. I've made up my numbers. I don't know what the dollar factor is. But there is no such thing as a freebie. Every determination to do one means deprivation somewhere else. And therefore, it is not a determination which can be made by an individual as if that individual were in a vacuum, not affecting other human lives. That simply is a fallacy. Therefore, I wonder whether or not the individual's consent is anything except an additional criteria that has to be met. I wouldn't force treatment upon any person. Don't think I would. Nor do I think that just because the person says, yes, I'd like to have my life saved, and that it's possible to do, means that that person is entitled in any sense to have his or her life saved.
So would ability to pay become the bottom line then? If we have two people with thalassemia, one can afford the...
Well, if I can use Leo's 10th law, I wouldn't put it quite as simply a cost, but rather a balancing of a whole bunch of complex factors that have to go into such a decision. And cost is one of them.
Another thing, when you mentioned you wouldn't force treatment on anyone, who makes that decision then for the child?
I reserve my right to talk about that tomorrow night. That's a terribly important question, obviously.
Is there a basic conflict between people choosing to intervene genetically and our notion that we are created by God, that God is basically in charge of his creation. Do we have any right to tinker in this rather fundamental way with creation? Is there any conflict here?
Who is to say what's fundamental? I mean, is injecting, at one point, injecting insulin is an exogenous administration of a natural hormone. I mean, isn't that interfering too? There you're interfering with the endocrine system as opposed to the, you know, genetic control for DNA.
You can carry that to a little farther and intervening surgically.
I'm still taking an aspirin is intervening.
No, by then, so
to a certain extent.
You brought up a point, and I have a little file on this subject. And I just remember this because I had a cartoon on the back, but I was saving the cartoon. In fact, it's a great cartoon. The sheep herder is sitting here, and I showed it to John Schramm tonight. And he looks like an old sheep herder, and the sheep are gathered around him, and he's talking to the sheep. We who keep sheep do this. How would you guys feel if I gave all this up and went on Social Security? He's talking to the sheep. But that's what I really cut this out for. But it's out of the New Yorker. And I always read, I check the cartoons, and then I read notes and comments in the New Yorker every week. In a discussion of the creation in the City of God, St. Augustine writes, "Whatever the physical or seminal causes that play their part in the production of living things by the activities of angels or of men, or by the intercourse of male and female in animals or human beings, whatever effect the longings or emotions in the mother's consciousness may have on the child in her womb, in its susceptible state, leaving some traces in the features or complexion, it remains true that only God Most High can create the actual natures which are thus affected in different ways, each in its own kind." And that's the end of the quotation. And then the writer says, "In recent years, God's monopoly, or nature's monopoly, if you wish, has been broken, and man, making use of refined methods of crossbreeding and of the newly discovered techniques of gene splicing, in which a gene belonging to one organism is fitted into the genetic substance of another, has acquired for his own use the power to create the actual natures of living things." And he goes on. You see, that's the question before the house, and that's why it's so charged. To get at, and it's a really a hot subject. Of course, we in the animal sciences, in veterinary medicine, and in the crop sciences, the next 20 years are going to be a fantastic time to live for the possibilities that we see, like many of the scourges of foot and mouth disease, for example. Now they're making the vaccine for that disease because you have a problem with this, because this is a virus that just hybridizes and mutates, and you make a vaccine this day and it doesn't work the next. So that looks good. And you mentioned nitrogen fixation to improve that in many plants. But this control of disease and modifying, we're big into monoclonal antibody and looking to breed a more resistant species. And now with not only artificial insemination but embryo transplant, and getting to cloning, you know, it's an exciting time to live. But it's for you folks to decide about the human thing. That isn't my category. I can be brought to court.
There's a woman here before we got started, and before anybody else was here, and I told her what the session was going to be, and she said, "Oh, I don't approve. That's playing God." And I don't know if she's here or not. But is it playing God? Or when do we play God?
I encounter a fair number of people whose view is that we were made a certain way in the image of God. God made us with certain abilities and disabilities, and that that's the natural order of things. And of course, all of medicine is intervention, if you will, when we don't like the outcome. This is something we shouldn't tamper with, is a viewpoint that a number of people I know feel very strongly, and I haven't heard that expressed tonight, and I'm just interested if any of you might feel
that. How many of those people who have that view have a major genetic disorder? How many does it affect them personally?
One person I know is a carrier for muscular dystrophy. She's a woman. She's had 3 sons. 2 of them have had muscular dystrophy. There's a 50-50 chance with sons. Now, she wishes that she knew a lot more genetics during the time she was reproducing, because she probably would not have had as many children as she had. And there are also, you can identify the sex of the child during pregnancy. There are certain options available. But she loved her son dearly, felt the time they had together was precious, and says that we're not alike, and we learn to love and care for other people who have disabilities relative to us. There is a very positive thing that spectrum of characteristics brings out in us.
Go ahead over here.
Some time ago I read the book, The Will of God, that he wrote, and I don't think that, and I agree with what he said, but you know, God doesn't wish upon us horrible things like smallpox or genetic disorders. They happen, but I don't think it's by the will of God that they do happen. And how that affects genetic engineering, I think, is something that society as a group needs to decide. But I don't think that it's the will of God. I think we all learn from people around us who have genetic disorders. It's not all bad.
Well, I wonder how much of the question is actually simply because the whole concept is so new that people just simply aren't used to it yet.
Well, there certainly is a fear of the unknown, and one more level of intervention that we now will have the capability to engage in.
It seems to me that while it is so new, that people are very tentative because they feel that we are establishing precedents. And you know, if it becomes duck soup to be able to get in there and alter the genetic structure, much of the precedents we establish now are going to be called upon. Okay, well, you did it for John Jones in that situation. Well, why can't we do it for so-and-so in this situation? And I think that's why many people are very, very tentative. Hey, what is the parameter? What are the parameters that we can deal with some measure of control before it gets beyond our control?
But I think to myself, I don't have a genetic disorder, but I had an appendectomy when I was 12. If I had been born 100 years ago, I probably would be dead when I was 12 years old. Were people afraid like we're afraid, or have that fear now?
I think the potential for abuse here is much, much greater. Yeah. I mean, if you want to just carry it on in a scientific vein, cloning people and having robots and armies and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. The potential is really there to start doing some of this stuff.
There's a fear of a dehumanizing, that we come to see people as objects, as means to ends rather than as ends in themselves. In fact, I've got a nice quote, very brief one. Can I just throw that one in? Be quiet again. This comes from Leon Cass. He's a bioethicist at the University of Chicago. He says this: "We've paid some high prices for the technological conquest of nature, but none perhaps so high as the intellectual and spiritual costs of seeing nature as mere material for manipulation, exploitation, and transformation. With the powers for biological engineering now gathering, there will be splendid new opportunities for similar degradation of our view of man. Indeed, we are already witnessing the erosion of our idea of man as something splendid or divine, as a creature with freedom and dignity. And clearly, if we come to see ourselves as meat, then meat we shall become. There is that underlying fear. A contrasting view is that we will have good common sense and be guided by sound principles as we proceed into the brave new world.
Well, I'm thinking of the history of the smallpox vaccination and the, what was it, two or three generations that it had to go through before it was even fully accepted as a proper medical procedure to begin with. And this may well be a similar situation, really.
On the other hand, there are other technological advances, and we've become victimized by, at least from my viewpoint, things like ventilators, artificial respirators, or whatever. I worked in intensive care units, and you get so that life or death becomes an academic thing. You know, look at all the problems we've had just with that concept of when is death. So it's even more complex than that. You're talking about making decisions of who's going to have and what things are important enough to have genetic transplant or what genetic engineering, which things are legitimate. We already have that problem.
It's a good example of that the rate of technology is upon us, and we suddenly are confronted with having to make decisions that we are ill-prepared for. There are all kinds of options we used to leave to nature because we didn't have any choice. All of a sudden we have a choice, and now we have to make decisions that we weren't in a situation of having to make decisions about before.
There's a classic example now. There are a lot of cases where the parents' rights are being challenged as opposed to children's rights, and I don't know, I don't remember it very well. You can help me with some of these twins, and badly with one, and the parents wanted nothing done. I mean, years ago we didn't have the technology so that there would even be a choice, and now these parents are villains and guilt-ridden, unfeeling creatures. You know, it's just, we've become victimized by the technology to some extent.
On the other hand, maybe the availability of respirators challenges us to decide what our attitudes are toward death and what kind of boundaries, instead of by default leaving the decision to nature in us. You know, you can say it's dehumanizing to have all these manipulations we can do. In another way, it's a very humanizing thing to be in a situation of being able to define with more precision than before what we are to be about, how we want to live and die.
Unfortunately, in the case with respirators, it's like a split second decision that's often made by people who are ill prepared. And in terms of an emergency room, we've never seen this patient, don't know anything about it from off the street, don't know how long he's been hypoxic or whatever. And then it becomes, once you've done it, then when do you undo it?
That seems to me to be an issue that's bothering me. I think the question was, if you can, should you? You have the, and once you started, what can you undo? I'm going to talk about amniocentesis. And I recall being in a committee meeting where there were physicians asking the same question, because amniocentesis can be used for good. I mean, it gives people options. You can find out whether early in the pregnancy, whether the mother is carrying a fetus that will be a handicapped fetus, a handicapped child. But there's other information that you get from amniocentesis, which includes the sex of the child yet to be born. And the issue that was raised at this meeting was raised by a physician who had told the mother of six boys that the child was another boy, and she says, no, thank you. And that says, if you can, must you, and then what happens? It seems to me that those are some of the kinds of questions that we also must think about when we decide to embark upon a yes, we can. There are so many decisions out there.
Did she elect to abort the child?
The physician was asking for what he should say to the mother.
I don't know about that particular case, but there are many abortions on the basis of I don't want a girl or I don't want a boy. That's statistically easy to prove.
There's also been this problem of deciding who should get the kidney transplant, or who, at least at one time, who would get the kidney machine, and they would say who would get the kidney transplant. And there again, somebody is making the right decision.
That's playing God.
Yeah, that's
by your definition, I suppose.
But this is not new.
But that's not new, that's right.
I happen to have lived in Calcutta, India in the spring of 1943. Watched in excess of 3 million people starve to death in 6 months, when it was easily within our competence to bring in food and take care of those people. However, we had a more important mission at the moment. We had to kill Japanese. So we made a decision to let 3 million people starve to death. That's the population of the state of Washington, 6 months.
I wonder, the issue might be addressed to the notion of weaponry. We've had the capability to blow ourselves to smithereens and demonstrated that 35, 36 years ago. And I don't think we've demonstrated that since. And that we haven't blown up any more cities besides the two that we did in Japan at that time. Maybe we are learning a little judgment in that, although it seems like we're on the ragged edge of it.
I have a hard time seeing a trend there, but I don't know that that's the issue.
We have we've come to an hour. Maybe there are a couple more comments that need to be made.
I'd like to ask about cloning from the human standpoint. In animal medicine, there's some interest to us. And it's kind of interesting here. I'm going to talk about use of animals in therapy. And one of the things we face is, we want to leave this in on a little lighter note. And one of the things we face is, I run into a lot of people that says, I want an animal just like that one. It's dying, it's 16 years old. I was in Cambridge about a year and a half ago. And there's a Dane working there in the reproductive lab. And that's where they started a lot of this embryo transplant. You're all familiar with that, and Cali, and superovulate. And what he had done was to superovulate a sheep, and then you he rescued a two-cell embryo, and he. He took out, two-cell embryo, that's what it was. And he separated these out. You see, this is one embryo, it's going to be one sheep. But he separated and put in little auger plugs, put it back into the ewe, took it out in about 4 days, and then put them in and separated, and they developed then into twins. In other words, he ended up with, out of one, it was going to be one sheep. He ended up with two sheep that were, of course, twins. Now that, you see, you have essentially a mirror, identical twins. So that, see, then what we have here is the capability to, you put one in the freezer, because we now have the technology for freezing embryos. And you go ahead and produce one, and you hope maybe it ends up being a little female lamb, which you can have then for a pet for 8-10 years. Then you at about 8 or 10, you pull out the other one out of the freezer, and then she gives birth to her twin. See, so then you, I know a sheep, her name's Gertrude, she's in Tennessee, she's 18. So So you see, you pretty much take care of a person with a pet, and if you like pet sheep, you see, you can follow it up. And have a pet.
The mother is the sister.
Yeah, the mother is a sister. The insect of the highest order. But you see, I say that not completely in jest, because I can see great possibilities in use of animal therapy for this, but you see this thing, I mean, we're using embryo transplant on people, aren't we?
What can you tell me, Leo, about the self-consciousness of the sheep? Does it know that it is one and the twin is another? No.
Their IQ is below detection.
Would a human being say, I'm going to live again in my clone, or would a human being say, well, it doesn't make any difference how the next person is born, I'm dead?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who like to see a clone of themselves.
I enjoy seeing my children and my grandchildren. I don't regard them as being me. I think I'd feel the same way if a cell of mine was cloned. In effect, my children and my grandchildren, in the Hebrew sense at least, are carrying on my life. I don't think I'd feel any different if a clone. I think that as far as I'm concerned, I would live, and then that entity would live. Because I don't think the entity is the body. I think it's the combination of body and mind and spirit that makes a person.
If I could get in a plug, we're getting into some other options in addition to genetic engineering, and those will be the subjects of some classes coming up this week. There's one on cloning and test tube babies and amniocentesis, and so quite a few of the issues relating to this will arise there. On the cloning one, it's kind of interesting. I was on a talk show in Seattle once, and a guy called in and said, if you clone somebody, would the clone, the copy, have a soul? And I said, oh, I think so. And he said, no, it wouldn't. And he referred me to some book, which I promised to read and didn't read. And I'm still not sure what his thinking was on that, but you can ponder that one.
The subject of the arms race was brought up before, and I guess I'd like to underscore that. I'm getting lots of flashbacks to when I did some research on the decision to use the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. I've done quite a lot of research on that, and I'm really struck by some similarities and wondering if we're not at a stage that we were in the 1940s in this research, and wondering whether now too, I'm wondering whether scientists are going to have the sense to stop at a certain point, and once things get underway, isn't it a snowballing effect, isn't it a chain reaction where the research continues without a purpose? We had a movie here in August called The Day After Trinity, sort of looked at the life of J. Robert Oppenheimer, who actually worked on the bomb, and it was clearly shown that after a while there was no reason any longer to work on the bomb, but they worked on it anyway because the whole motion was in process and they had spent the money. And I really wonder if we don't have to right now look at those connections and wonder...